Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Find a horse and cart. I'm just a country boy.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. From an early age, Ricky Skaggs knew he was going to play music. As he tells us in his new memoir, Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music, the country and bluegrass star picked up a mandolin at just 5 years old. By the time he was in his teens, he was traveling and playing with some of the biggest names in bluegrass. Since then, he's won more Grammy Awards than we can count and has topped the U.S. country charts even more times than that. He joins me here in the studio, Ricky Skaggs. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you, sir. Great to be with you, John.
Page one struck me in your book because you start off by talking about your eighth great-grandmother.
Yeah.
You can trace your family back to like the 1700s.
We can.
That's an amazing... To be that deeply rooted, not just to the land, but to know the family and how they interacted with the land.
I think it's that Celtic nature that's in us, you know, us a hardy bunch.
Yeah.
You know, there was a guy called the Long Hunters, and those guys.
I had never heard that term before reading your book. What is a Long Hunter?
There was a band of hunters came out of Virginia into the new Western expansion, which was, the Cumberland River area and even, this actually east of the Mississippi.
Kentucky, Tennessee.
Right. And so some of them would come and just kind of chart the waterways and chart mountain ranges and that kind of thing. It was part of what they did, the Skaggses. But these hunters would go on these long hunts for like 2 years, and they would shoot deer. I mean, there was such a plentiful stock of elk and deer and buffalo even in Kentucky in those days in Tennessee.
Yeah.
And so they were hunters, and, you know, they sold their goods. And, you know, Henry Skaggs, you know, did well just, you know, just selling hides and stuff. So 1760s and 70s into Kentucky, into Tennessee. They were actually through the gap before Boone came through in the 70s. So,
Daniel Boone, that Johnny come lately.
Yeah, he was a Henry Skaggs wannabe.
Ricky Skaggs is my guest on Soundcheck. The book describes the arc of your career in a way that I found very telling. A lot of our listeners will know you from your country hits, especially from the 1980s.
Right.
It's page 209 when we finally get you in Nashville.
Yeah.
The book is bluegrass, 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 country, bluegrass, bluegrass.
Yeah, right.
I mean, is that where your heart has always lay?
It seems to be, and I didn't maybe think it so much until I really started chronicling, you know, through the book and seeing, golly, it has been bluegrass all the way, even though there was a stint there of country mixed with bluegrass.
Right.
You know, the bluegrass people got mad at me for leaving the first time, and then they got mad because I came back, you know. So it's just like you can't win. So anyway, God bless them. But it's been an interesting thing, you know, to sit back and read this now that it's all been put together. You know, I mean, you get so focused on one particular story or one section or maybe, you know, one chapter, and then I got away from it for a week or two, and I'd come back and I'd do some more stuff, you know, but reading it now and seeing how it flows together, it's an amazing bunch of great stories, but just how doors were opened to me at a young age. You know, my dad was always at the right place at the right time. You know, getting me in front of either Bill Monroe or Earl Scruggs.
Blanton Scruggs.
Yeah. And
it's an interesting life and one that has been surprisingly well documented. Listen to this. This is my guest, Ricky Skaggs, at age 7 on The Martha White Show with Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs.
It's time now to call on our special guest, little Ricky again. Ricky, you all drove back and ready to go? What you going to do for us this time?
Ruby,
that's a good...
Oh, Ruby,
Ricky Skaggs, you were one self-possessed little seven-year-old.
Oh, the innocence of youth.
That's you playing the mandolin, which was your first love.
Yes, sir.
With Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. So that's 1961. Mm-hmm. And you'd been playing for a couple of years by then, but yeah. You must have taken to... Were you... I mean, if you had grown up in Austria in the early 1800s, you would have been a child prodigy and sort of like, you know... been taken to the capitals of Europe. And sort of like,
well, I was taken to Nashville. What do you want?
Well, that's, I guess that's, it's pretty amazing that for somebody who lived in a holler, mm-hmm. which I'm not even sure still what a holler is. Is that just a valley or something between two hills?
Kind of so, yeah. It's a valley kind of a place, and usually there was enough room. It usually followed the creek line or something like that. You'd drive, they'd build a road, and sometimes you'd have to go up over the hill to keep from getting in the creek. But these hollers are sometimes the flatlands between the two mountain ranges or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And we lived up Brushy Creek up a holler.
And yet it seems like everybody came through there because, as you mentioned, Bill Monroe, Ralph Stanley.
Yeah.
And there you are at age 15 touring with Ralph Stanley. The legendary master of...
Oh, absolutely.
As they call it, the high lonesome sound.
Right, the man of constant sorrow.
Right.
Interesting story about, I had met Ralph and Carter, his brother, the Stanley brothers. I had met them and actually played a show with them in Prestonsburg, Kentucky, when I was like nine, I mm-hmm. think. I'd played with Mr. Monroe when I was six and then the Flat Scruggs thing at seven. So that kind of gave me a little credit card there. You know, my dad said, well, now he played with Flat and Lester and Earl and with Monroe. And so Ralph and Carter let me on with no problem, you know. But Keith Whitley and I met when we were 15. Mm-hmm. I was playing a show and with my dad. And Keith was playing the same show with his brother and a couple of guys, and somehow we ended up in the boys' locker room under the stage somehow, and we're down there and totally uninterrupted for like an hour and a half, just the two of us, and we were talking about music that we loved. Well, we found out that Ralph Stanley was coming to Fort Gay, West Virginia, and in 2 or 3 months, and so. Here, the only songs that we really knew was Stanley Brothers songs, and so we went to Fort Gay, West Virginia, to see Ralph, and the club owner came up to us and said, Ralph just called and said his bus, had a flat tire, and he's going to be, about 45 minutes to an hour late. Said, you reckon you boys could get up and sing a few things, and so we, thank goodness, had our instruments in the car because Dad was like, don't leave home without it. He should have got credit for that,
the American Express
commercial.
Yeah.
But anyway, we got up and played some music, and after about 30 or 40 minutes, Ralph comes walking in, and he really discovers us. And that was a defining moment for us because that introduced us to Ralph, reintroduced me and Ralph together, but introduced him to a great lead singer in Keith Whitley. And so that summer, we went out and did 3 or 4 shows with Ralph, and then we got out of high school the next year, and Ralph gave us a full-time job. And but that really started a relationship, and especially in bluegrass, the people that was the talk of the bluegrass circuit was those two young boys with Ralph. That was who we were.
And you mentioned in the book that when you did first meet Keith Whitley, you were sort of shocked to find out he was from like the next town or the next holler over.
Yeah,
and you had
isn't it amazing? I mean, how that sounds so ancient now. I mean, now that with Facebook and and Instagram and And I could have tweeted, I guess, over there if we'd have had phones back then, cell phones. But we didn't have any of that, mm-hmm. And so he was the next holler over, and I'd never really heard of him, and he'd never really heard of me.
So you mentioned that when Ralph Stanley meets you and Keith, he sort of meets a new lead singer in Keith. You were singing, too.
Yeah, I was singing, and Ralph had a lead singer. That's who actually we had gone to see was Ralph's new lead singer, Roy Lee Centers, but that sounded so much like Carter. And they had this great, great duet. But Ralph did sing, Keith did sing lead, and I would sing tenor. Mm-hmm. And then when we sang with Ralph, then I jumped up to Pee Wee Lambert's parts, which was the really high part above Ralph, and then Keith would sing Carter's part, and Ralph would sing his Ralph part, which was always great. And so we would sing these old trios from the 40s that Ralph didn't think we knew, you know. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. we would sing, you know, those high lonesome songs like Lonesome River and Angels Are Singing in Heaven Tonight and Fields Are Turned Brown and White Dove and all those things that they had hits on Columbia in the 40s, you know. So that just blew his mind. And so when we go out on the festival circuit, wow, people got to hear songs that they hadn't heard in 30 or 40 years. So it was really, really cool to see a young generation of kids coming along singing old Ralph Stanley songs. I mean, I think it gave a lot of the old timers hope for the yeah. future, but it also inspired a bunch of the young kids to follow that.
Ricky Skaggs, my guest on Soundcheck, what you just said pertains to an early part of your career, but could just as easily apply to today.
Mm-hmm.
Young generation of kids yeah. growing up
yeah.
with bluegrass and old-timey and Appalachian music is just, you know, it could be on the iPod right next to Jay-Z and Coldplay.
That's right. And I think there's a lot of kids now in Eastern Kentucky probably that has that on their iPod, you know. And, you know, times have changed a lot. But, you know, we off the air, we were talking about Chris Thiele and the Punch Brothers.
The mandolinist,
and all
yeah.
that he's done. My heart so beats for young kids to know what I know. You know, I want to pass that along. I want to pass that down. That's important to me to do that because I want them to go back to the same well that I went to mm-hmm. because that well is there, you
right.
know. And thank goodness for, you know, for iTunes, we can go there now and find Flat Scruggs with Monroe, you know, from 46, mm-hmm. you know, 47, 48, the 3 years they were there together making records. You can find those things now. You can find Pee Wee Lambert singing all that stuff with the Stanley Brothers. You can find the Columbia set now. Mm-hmm. You can find all the Mercury recordings.
You can watch bluegrass being made.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's so important for these kids. And so when I go to Berkeley and talk to these kids, I mean, I just fire them up. I said, look, you know, it's one thing to learn John Scofield today, you know, and I want you to because John is, you know, he's viable and he's worth learning about. But if you want to know about bluegrass, go back and listen. You know, don't start with the Lonesome River Band. Don't start with Boone Creek. Don't start with J.D. Crow in the New South. You know, go back to Bill Monroe and Flat Scruggs and the
something?
Band.
I did start with those bands, with you know, J.D. Crow and the New
yeah.
South.
Well, that's
and
where
the
a lot of people got
so.
On to yeah, they got onto it right there.
Yeah.
And but I'm telling you, there's such a well of information and music back there that still hasn't been, you know, completed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that well mm-hmm. is still there.
Well, spoken like a man who can trace his family back to the early 1700s. Ricky Skaggs' book is called Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music. Speaking of the New South, I mean, mm-hmm. that gets us into a period of time where, you know, you're no longer a teenager. You're finding your right. place in the music world.
Mm-hmm.
You've grown up with bluegrass, but you also write that you loved the Beatles and the Stones
yeah.
and the Everly Brothers.
Yeah.
And at some point, singing becomes as important to you as playing, and it's Emmy Lou Harris who gives you that first opportunity to sing lead.
She did, and I'll always be thankful for Emmy Lou and what she afforded me in that band. I guess it was The Darkest Hours Just Before Dawn, which here again is another Stanley Brother classic.
Mm-hmm.
She and I did that song together on the Roses and the Snow record, and you know, she just said to me when we were working it up out at her house out in North Hollywood, she said, why don't we do a modulation and you take a verse, you know? And I went, well, gosh, Emmy, this is your record. She said, well, I think it would be great if you just, you know, take a verse of it, and then we can sing the chorus and take it out, you know?
So she's and doing for you what Graham Parsons had done
for her. See, so she was spreading the love. I mean, she was passing it down and trying to lend a hand, you know, doing what Bill Monroe did for me at 6 years old, what Ralph Stanley did for me, or what Flat Scruggs did at 7, what Ralph did at 15. And so I've had a lot of help along the way, and I hope that when people read this book, they see the appreciation and the love that I – and the honor that I try to give these people in this book.
Well, it's a pivotal moment in Ricky Skaggs' career, getting to sing lead on this Emmy Lou Harris track from her album Roses in the Snow from 1980. Recording by Emmy Lou Harris from her album Roses in the Snow. That's The Darkest Hour is Just Before Dawn, featuring my guest Ricky Skaggs on lead vocals.
Singing at the big time. I'd gone to the big house to get to sing on a big major label on Warner Brothers. Wow. I'd done a solo album for Sugar Hill, a much smaller label.
Yeah. Yep.
So for her to be able to, you know, bless me like that. That was really, really sweet. You know?
So, and it was also kind of, in a way, there were other feet in the door, but it was a foot in the door to the world of major label, country music, Nashville, Music Row, and you went through that door.
I did. That was something that, you know, was offered me. I mean, I did a record for Sugar Hill, and the deal that I made with them is that I would do a two record deal. And so I really owed them a second record. So after Sweet Temptation came out and kind of did what it did, which was a great record. Emmy Lou had sang on the original cut of with me, that was my first single called I'll Take the Blame, which was another Stanley Brothers song that we had taken and kind of countryfied a little bit with a pedal steel guitar and all that. We did a second record that had Honey Open That Door, Don't Cheat in Our Hometown, Head Over Heels in Love with You. Dolly Parton come in and sung Vision of Mother, which was another Stanley Brother thing. And so I had all of these songs kind of as the second record for Sugar Hill, and I had them in, you know, on my... We had a Walkman back in those days, buddy. You remember Walkman. So anyway, here's how divine some of this stuff was, and I can't overstate how incredible this you know, these kind of things was, but I was sitting in the back of an airplane flying to Nashville. Actually, I had to go to Atlanta. Then I was going to go actually on home to Lexington, Kentucky. So I'm sitting back there. I'd been with Emmy Lou and been, you know, recording for days. And so I was going home to see the family. And all of a sudden, this airline stewardess comes back and says, I have a seat up front. Would you like to sit in first class? I thought, who do I have to kill? Stooges thing. And she said, no, I've got a seat up there. Would you like to come up there and sit? And I was a total nobody. Nobody knew who I was at that time. So I said, well, sure. So I grabbed my bag and I take off up front. And there was just one seat left. And I sat down over by the window over there and, you know, put my stuff out because I knew I wanted to listen to some music and make some notes and stuff on the way home. And I sat down beside a guy named Jim Mazza, which was the head or the vice president of United Artists. And so we're talking, you know, what do you do? And I said, well, I play music. I play with Emmy Lou. Well, what are you listening to? What's a new record I'm doing? And, well, I'm in the record business, you know, shakes my hand. He said, could I take a listen to your stuff? I'd love to hear it, you know.
Right there on the
right
plane.
Right there on the plane. And so I hand him my Walkman, and he's sitting there, and he's listening. This is you?
Yeah.
So who produced this stuff? I said, well, I did, you know. And he said, do you know this could get you signed, as you know? And I said, well, gosh, you know. And I said, well, this belongs to Sugar Hill Records. And so he said, could you be in Nashville tomorrow? And I said, well, yeah. So I stay an extra day and go to Nashville and play this stuff for the Capitol people there in Nashville. Well, they love it. They're up dancing and just think this is a slam dunk. And they said we have to get an approval from a guy, Don Grierson, out in Los Angeles. And so they made a copy, pouched it out to him. He listens to it and comes back and says, "Pass, El Paso."
Mm-hmm.
And so Lynn Schultz from Capitol says he's got rocks in his ears. He's not hearing this at all. But I'm going to make a phone call. If you've got 10 minutes, I want you to go down and see a friend. So he picks up the phone and calls Rick Blackburn at CBS and sends me down to see Rick. Rick said, "Yeah, I can see him." So I take that tape down there.
Just so people know what you're saying, this is the New York Yankees saying, "You are great. Why don't you go play for the Mets?"
Exactly. That's exactly what we're saying here. I mean, it was like, and I know that Lynn really wanted to sign me to Capitol, but I think it was here again. It was just God's plan for me to be signed at CBS, because that was exactly where I needed to be. Rick Blackburn. When he wanted to make something happen, and Sony was such, I mean, because before Sony bought CBS,
right.
but Epic was such a big machine. CBS was a huge machine. When they really wanted to do something, they could get it done. And Rick Blackburn pulled out all the stops to make it happen for me.
He got it done. This is one of the resulting hits for Ricky Skaggs, called "Crying My Heart Out Over You."
But like a fool, I stood and watched you go. Now I'm crying my heart out over you. Those blue eyes, now they smile at someone new. Ever since you went away, I die a little more each day. 'Cause I'm crying my heart out over you.
Ricky Skaggs,
wow.
"Crying My Heart Out Over You." That's just 1 year after the Emmy Lou Harris song.
It sure was. And I was just hearing I don't know if it was confidence or the maturity or something. Something had changed there within a year,
mm-hmm.
and of being maybe a little shy, a little scared, you know, into, well, gosh, hey, I'm pushed up there now. I go from Emmy Lou from a band member now to a front man.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to front my own show, and that was not an easy thing either. You know, just learning how to MC. Learning how to, you know, to carry a band and do all that kind of stuff. Man, that was, you know, having everything done for me with Emmy Lou's band. I mean, because she had, you know, all this help and all these roadies on the road and management and all this stuff. That was, it was a new and different way to get music out there.
You either have to grow up fast or you don't grow up at all,
That's
it
right.
seems.
Yeah. Sink or swim.
And you know, the book, Kentucky Traveler, My Life and Music, is not without occasional regrets. You know, there were occasional missteps. You talked about the long hunters before, the ones who'd be away for a couple of years.
Right.
Musicians are like long hunters. You were away from home and your kids for a long time.
That's right.
Cost you your first marriage.
Yep.
What about the idea of this tour, that the tobacco sponsored tour,
mm-hmm.
that you and a bunch of other you were not a smoker,
no,
but and you write in the book that you were young and naive and you kind of got into this.
Yeah.
I mean, did that sort of thing happen a lot when you were making your way in Nashville?
Well, it was, and I looked at it. You know, I didn't look at it as that I was promoting. You know, telling young kids to get up and start smoking cigarettes. I mean, I wasn't telling them that at all. I was looking at it as a way for me to get my music out there and get the message out there and put me in front of 25,000 people that I wouldn't normally get to play. I mean, normally we had 2,500 people that we'd play to at night, and that would take, you know, a long time to get to play for 25,000 people, you
right.
know. So, and we were doing that night after night on the road with Hank Jr. and Barbara Mandrell or Merle Haggard would go out with us some or George Strait, you know, Ronnie Millsap, you know, we just had a great crew, and but usually I, for some reason, they took a liking to me, and I was able to, you know, play almost every show, whether we'd have a different main headliner, you know. So it was a great way for me to, you know, to get my feet wet in front of an audience that big. So, you know, I didn't have regrets about the tobacco thing. I mean, I told them, I said, look, if you want me to go out and promote cigarettes, I ain't going to do that.
Right.
But I said, I will, you know, I'll do your shows.
One of the other kind of running battles you had is, and this again is a theme that recurs throughout the book, is your own faith. And and you use the word musicianary.
Yeah.
Using the fact that you have a microphone and a stage to kind of, you know, make your faith evident to, to the audience. And the fact that some people at the record companies didn't like this kind of thing.
Yeah, we Rick Blackburn and I had more than a dozen conversations about that, you know, and I would go out and play clubs or play radio appreciation days or something like that, and people would say, do a gospel song, which just fed into it, you know, and I said, okay, so I'd sing a gospel song. Well, this is a song about what I really believe in, And so sometimes it would just rub people the wrong way, you know, especially if there was a lot of people out there drinking and having a big time. And it almost like threw a blanket on the fire somehow, you know. And so I'd come back and the radio people would be all mad and they'd tell Rick, you know, you need to get your boy to, you know, quiet, pipe it down there, you know. So anyway, just walking through all of that, learning how to do it in a way that didn't offend but yet still got a message across. And, you know, and I just didn't do a good job of it at times. And
well,
I know
that's a really difficult thing. You're serving two masters at the same time.
It
then.
Is. And I think I've gotten a lot better at it now. But I think, too, that the kind of music that I'm playing now, bluegrass, It just, I don't know, the gospel and bluegrass is a thread that runs through a cloth, you know. It's not like you pull it and the whole thing falls apart, but still, you know, the gospel is such a big part of bluegrass music. It's part of our upbringing in the country. It's part of our DNA. It's part of just who we are.
A lot of those old Stanley Brothers songs.
Absolutely. And in country music, country western, it wasn't so much, you know. It's like I almost felt forced in a way to push it. And I didn't really want to hurt people that way.
The name of the Lord is music. The name of the Lord is music. The name of the Lord is music to my ears. I'm going to sing and shout it. Going to tell all about it. Cannot live without it in this veil of tears. Of the Lord is music to my ears. The peace of the nations is music. The peace of the nations is music. The peace of the nations is music to my ears. When Babel was divided, our tongues grew in his sight. All are united in song that's crystal clear. The peace of the nations is music to my ear. I'm gonna sing and shout it. Gonna tell all about it. Cannot live without it.
But I gotta say, you know, Rick knew my heart, and he knew my commitment to Christ. And so as tough as it was for him to have to, you know, as tough as it was for me to have to kind of learn how to do that on the stage, it was equally as hard for him to set me down and talk to me about, you know, my faith and how I was sharing it in a way, you know, that was hard for them to, you know, to get behind. And I remember, supporting a presidential candidate, a Republican, And, oh, my God, it was like, you know, I had committed, you know, a cardinal sin. You
in
know?
Nashville?
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. It was, you know, especially, you know, for them. And of course, this presidential candidate was a strong, big-time Christian and was against a lot of things. And anyway, you know, and Rick wasn't there. I mean, Rick had gone on, moved on, but I remember the head of the record label said, well, we don't want you to do that. Mm. And I said, well, I understand, but I feel like I need to do that, you know. And they said, well, I just want to let you know that if you do that, you know, we're not going to support you, you know. And so, you know, I had to make a decision, you know, and but they dropped me pretty much like a dirty shirt, you know. And but, you know, it's okay, you know.
That's not okay. I mean, I probably could guess who you're talking about in terms of the candidate, and it's certainly not someone I would ever want to deal with. But what you're talking about is un-American. You know, it's like they can control if they have a contract to control your music, but they can't control your political leanings and your beliefs. That's crazy.
But they can suggest, and they can. You know, they can write you off the list of people that they want to get behind, you know. So anyway, it all worked out, you know, and
So you're out of the maw of the beast and back to where you belong, making bluegrass records and...
On my own label.
On your own label.
Thank goodness, yeah.
And your whole career has been about collaboration, and you continue to collaborate today.
I do. We got a new project with my old pal Bruce Hornsby. We did a studio record about 5 years ago and went out and toured that and worked up a bunch of cool songs and other than just what was on the record. And we went through those live shows and just found a treasure trove of cool things. Mm-hmm. And so we have a new CD coming out called Cluck Old Hen, and which was Bruce's title. He loved that, from an encore that we did one night. And so it's some real cool bluegrass versions of The Way It Is, which was his big hit, and of course a 13-minute Grateful Dead version of White Wheel Limousine.
Because Bruce did play for the Grateful Dead
for
a while.
Yeah.
And you guys will be in the New York area, Huntington, New York, on November 20th, playing at the Paramount. That'll be Ricky Skaggs and Bruce Hornsby and band.
Yeah.
We're going to wrap up with you and Jack White and the Raconteurs and that version you guys did a few years back of Old Enough, yet another collaboration. There are many, many more, and they are all detailed in Ricky Skaggs' book called Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music. It's a very full life. We've barely skimmed the surface, but Ricky, it's been great having you with us.
Thank you, John. You're a great interviewer. I really enjoyed it so much.
When I was young, I thought I knew. You're probably thinking you know too. Do you? Well, do you? I was naive, just like you. I thought I knew exactly what I wanted.